This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend. I've walked your snow-capped mountains.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is October 22nd, 2020, and this is episode 212.
I'm Scott Lunnebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we look at the end of the campaign and make our predictions for what will happen Saturday or whenever we finally know the results of this election, probably after a few weeks. And we check in at how the House of Commons averted a federal election this week, but we could always be thrown into one next week. First, thanks to the 104 people who contribute to make this show happen every month. It helped us bring our special platform podcast earlier this week. Support the podcast at patreon.com/politicoast and help us keep bringing you BC poly and federal politics content even after the election. And as a reminder, the election is Saturday. If you're listening to this before then and haven't voted, make sure to vote. Polls are open till 8 p.m. Elections BC's website will tell you where to vote. Make sure to take your ID. And Politicoast, as always, is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. We're almost done. Almost.
I cannot wait for this to be over. It's been both a surprisingly long and short campaign, but most importantly, or at least the thing that's bugging me the most right now is, I don't know, it seems like everyone I know has a bad case of election brain that's like constantly blowing everything into the most partisan take on everything, and I'm just ready for that to be over, at least toned down like 10 to 20%.
It doesn't help that nothing happened this week.
No, it was for a final week of the campaign, everyone more or less seemed to be on autopilot.
I guess when you can't have rallies and you can't have events and all you can do are like virtual announcements and maybe a half-assed attempt to do a rally or announcement on site, it ends up just being a lot of repetition of what we discussed last week that was in the platform. So yeah, just re-announcement after re-announcement, and people stopped caring. I don't know. The journalists were still following it around, but it was also just a number of press conferences that were canceled or moved. I think the only thing that came up this week again was that Andrew Wilkinson is still a doctor.
To remind us, we may have forgotten in the last 5 minutes since he previously announced it.
There was like a day or two of controversy where he talked about how he would be more involved with public health or something because he was a doctor. And that drew some criticism.
Like 12 people on Twitter criticism. Like, I don't think it really spilled out into the broader campaign.
But other than that, I think Sonia Firstenau was spending a lot of time on the island, particularly in her own riding. John Horgan was jumping all around. I think Andrew Wilkinson was jumping all around too, often on and off of trucks. He liked to do a lot of announcements off of trucks this campaign.
I guess when you get in big rallies or standing on the back for truck works.
Maybe let's look at the campaign as a whole then, rather than this week of nothing. Takeaways, highlights, anything you actually did enjoy?
I mean, a debate where all the leaders were able to form complete sentences and express coherent thoughts. But like that is only a good thing in comparison to the disaster that is going on south of the border. No, not really. There's nothing that really stands out as a highlight on this campaign at all. You?
You're right in that I am much happier talking about this campaign than the U.S. presidential debate that's happening right as we record. I have no interest in watching that, even if they do mute Donald Trump. They didn't need to mute any of our leaders, and they all spoke intelligently even if it was like different levels of engaging. Ultimately, I think it was the campaign the NDP wanted, though. They wanted a boring campaign. They started the campaign in the lead with a clear advantage over the other parties, especially the Liberals. And so a campaign that doesn't really involve much happening, the standard stuff happens. There's a debate. There's some platforms and some promises, but nothing really moved much as far as we can tell. Maybe in the last week, but we only have one poll, which we'll get to. It seems like they got the exact campaign they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how the campaign broke down, kind of on a week-by-week basis, so week one, it was all about whether or not a election should be called, and the NDP and John Horton never really came up with a coherent answer that made any sense on that one. But after a week, yeah, it stopped being the thing everyone was talking about because the Liberals announced they wanted to do a big PST cut for a year. That kind of was what was mostly talked about second week, but I saw no indication it really penetrated too much outside of media bubbles and people who were already highly tuned into the campaigns. Next week was NDP platform, a bit there, we had debates, there was a couple, the controversies around some of the candidates, and that's more or less been about it. There was no real week that things really took off, or there was a real discussion about substantively different visions about where BC should be going, and overall, it just felt like an empty background campaign that didn't really talk about much or offer British Columbians a compelling reason why it's really important to go out and vote and decide the future of the province. I know this is politics, but we're supposed to be super excited about an election campaign. This should be our Christmas. And after several weeks of it, I'm tired, a little confused as why we're even doing this still, beyond the obvious pure power play move on the NDP's part, and just, I don't know, entirely unenthused and uninterested in this because there were really no like significant issues being talked about, or it was various forms of more or less continue on and tack slightly left or right, but that's about it.
I think the Liberals, you're right, with their PST pitch did try to make something happen. But as far as I could tell, unless you were a Liberal supporter, you were either lukewarm or negative to that idea. And if you were an NDP supporter or like a partisan, you were hostile to it. So it's exactly as you'd predict. And given how things were going in, I think the people who were on the fence, if there were undecided voters or people who are soft NDP supporters, I don't know, it didn't speak to them. I think I saw a couple people who suggested maybe this is a bit more weird. Like it was almost too wacky. It didn't seem like a coherent, this is what will save us. This is what will, you know, help us get out of the pandemic. It's just, that wouldn't suck, but it so what kind of thing?
It felt a little out of step. If they'd, 2009, if in 2009, this had been a platform pledge by the Liberal Party, you're in in economic trouble, you can see the case for this. I think it might have had a lot more resonance. A decade later, tax cut politics feel a lot more just exhausted as a main avenue of politics. And it also felt incongruous with the overall situation, which was much, more obviously pandemic and public health focused. And there isn't the obvious, or let me rephrase that. It isn't necessarily obvious that the economic troubles are going to be significantly eased with a PST or broadly a more favorable tax situation, because it's very clear that's not the reason we're in this situation. And if you're the type of person who spends a lot of time, thinking about free market politics or free markets and stuff, you can work yourself into being enthusiastic about it. But I don't think anyone else really was. And then it didn't help that the NDP was reasonably successful at convincing people that this was a giveaway to yacht purchasers, which, yeah, it's disingenuous a bit, because progressives for the last dozens of decades have been arguing that sales taxes are regressive. It's a campaign. The fact that the liberals weren't able to counter the attack on it just reveals a pretty weak campaign on their part.
The other thing the liberals really tried to run on was this tough on crime rhetoric, this spinning the overdose crisis as something that needed more cops, a different approach to treatment. Some specific candidates criticized the approach on safe supply that the NDP has taken. I've seen that up in some of the more northern candidates. I don't recall what the main platform's focus was. Well, it just wasn't as...
I think to be a little clear, it wasn't necessarily a response to the overdose crisis, but more kind of other spillover consequences of drug use in general.
Highlight in the platform, though, on overdose, that increasing community safety, and that is part of their response, though. They did tie it all together. But at the same time, I get who it was trying to speak to. There is a electorate within parts of Metro Van in particular, and outside Metro Van, who look at some of the challenges happening in the parks we've talked about, in the homeless camps in numerous areas, and wonder, why isn't something being done? And the truth is that these are incredibly difficult issues that are longstanding and entrenched, and they don't fix themselves overnight. But the thing a lot of people always want to turn to is just send in the cops, maybe send a psych worker with them. And it just overlooks the larger conversations we've been having as a society about police accountability and how much money we put in versus what we get. Without even saying any candidate out there needed to go full defund the police, it didn't resonate, and I didn't see a large resonance with the public on, oh yeah, tough on crime is this thing we need right now.
So I definitely think it resonated with some people, and you know, to be fair to liberals, like, there are definitely negative spillovers to the encampments in the parks and all that, and like, it's entirely reasonable for people to be concerned about it. And sometimes a lot of the discussions, particularly from progressives, can often come off as a little highly focused on the people dealing with the addictions and less on the spillovers. And I can see a spot for the liberals to exist in that space and speak to those issues. But once again, it was hard to really see how that would be the thing that would catch fire with the general public. And that was, I think, the problem with a lot of the liberal platforms. Like, individually, you can see the constituency they would speak to, but there was nothing that really, there's no connective tissue there, or there's no one thing that would be the ballot box question, which you can rally a province behind to go out and vote for you.
Well, and across the aisle, you had the NDP putting forward basically the platform that was, everything we've done, we're going to do that a little bit faster. We're going to do childcare a little bit faster. And we promise we'll do it this time. We'll do the renter's rebate that we said we'd do. And we'll give everyone $1,000 or $500 if you live alone, just as a little lazy vote buying promise. But there wasn't anything super new in there. There was a pledge to make transit free for youth. There's a few other like little tidbits, but very few standout policies.
Yeah, the NDP,
I guess, trying to build off the competent manager reputation.
Yeah, so the NDP's election message really had nothing to do with any of the individual issues. Like, the key message there was all about strong, stable majority government. Everything else was just the outcome of what that would be. But it was not a particularly policy-heavy campaign from the NDP, because they didn't want the ballot box question to be about any particular policy. They want it to be about continuity of leadership in a time of stress. And on that front, like they did a reasonable job. I mean, there's the fact that neither the other parties had a real coherent response to that kind of did a lot to help them. But yeah, if the NDP's goal was to make the case to British Columbians for continuity, I don't know how many minds they changed on it, but they managed to avoid, I think, turning anyone away from that or coming. But they definitely managed to avoid a situation where people were coming to the opposite conclusion to that.
Yeah, the Greens, I think, did manage to pull off a better campaign than might have been expected on day one, right? They came in with a brand new leader, struggled to fill their slate. I think they hit 75 or so candidates out of 87. So they didn't quite fill all of the seats, but they managed to get most of the ones that they were definitely targeting. And they put together a platform that covered most of the issues. Some of them went to the left of the NDP. Some of them went to a bit more centrist. And First Now really performed well in the debate, which I think got her a lot of credit and a lot of attention that maybe led to a slight uptick in the one poll we saw this week from Angus Reid. But who knows, because all the pollsters are going to release tomorrow when our episode comes out. So there may have been a huge swing this week that we don't know, that we haven't picked out, because everyone lives in social media bubbles as well.
I think that's probably going to be a little unlikely. But yeah, despite them starting in a not great position, they haven't really done much to really change that either. I think the debate helped, definitely. But I think it's telling that Sonja First Now is more or less spending the last week of the campaign in her home riding, which, when a leader's doing that, it's never a good sign. And the Green Party's clearly worried that they're not going to be able to hold the two seats they currently do. Yeah. If the goal was to avoid a holding action, at least try and capture some new territory, on that front, the Greens have not succeeded. Or I should say, don't look like they're going to succeed, because we don't actually know the results yet.
The Greens did manage to avoid the controversies that plagued the other campaigns a bit more. The Liberals, as we discussed, had a number of candidate difficulties with leaked or published Zoom videos. There was the infamous Jane Thornthwaite one, stuff from Laurie Thronis. There are still the questions about why they were running the councillor, Margaret Kunst, who had voted against a Pride sidewalk just before running for the province. The NDP had questions around both how they appointed Nathan Cullen and his not nice, but I struggled to see them as racist, although they have been called racist by some Indigenous people in Northern BC against one of his opponents.
Yeah, on the Cullen thing, I think it's more a case that there was already this existing narrative of disrespect to Indigenous British Columbians due to the fallout from the nomination process. And if that existing narrative wasn't there, it would have been a complete non-issue and instead became a brief controversy, but one that's unlikely to make a difference overall.
But it felt like there was a bit of a truce with the Greens. The Greens were running a positive campaign and didn't want to attack the others. And so there may have just been an unspoken agreement with the other campaigns to not go after individual Green candidates. They may have also just felt a little bad for them that they were struggling to find candidates, picking on the random Green candidate in Kelowna who put their name forward and is clearly not going to win, doesn't really win anyone any points.
So I am not sure on that at all. In fact, I find that pretty doubtful that this is coming from a, you know, place of nicety. There were few things more vitriolic than the hate a lot of New Democrats have for the Green Party, particularly the people deeply involved in partisan NDP politics. And if there was a chance to knock the Greens out, I think the people on the NDP campaign would be ecstatic about the possibility. Like, more so than winning a majority, I think what the NDP would really like to see is no Green seats in the House once this is done, because they want to hold the entire half of the spectrum for themselves. So there is no political incentive to play nice with the Greens and every political incentive to try and knock them down. John Horgan this week was in Sonya First Now's riding. I think Jamie Singh may have even made a visit there. Like, they are clearly trying to win both in Cowichan and in Saanich, at Saanich North in the island, and trying to recapture those. I think it was either a case that the OPPO resources were taken up focusing on the Liberals, or the Greens, for the first time ever, managed to put together a slate that was relatively unproblematic and didn't have many Bowser eruptions or vetting misses.
I think the key thing is that there's not actually an upside to picking something that's a marginal case. Like, I'm sure you could go through the list of Green candidates and go through all their social media and find questionable, like, you, but you, unless you have that, like, eugenics level comment from Lori Thronis, if, you know, that fictional Green candidate I picked off in Kelowna had said something like Nathan Cullen had said, flagging that just makes you look like a dick. And I think there is a negative, there is a political downside to being dickish to someone who's not got a strong shot, especially if it's like a 19-year-old who's running for the first time.
That's what campaign surrogates are for. That's what feeding stories to friendly reporters is for. It wouldn't be the case that John Horgan would go out there and be the pointy end of the stick on this one, but there are absolutely ways to...
Agree they'd go after Furstenau, Olson, or a handful of others where the Greens had a shot if there was something meaty there.
Yeah, I remember in 2017 when there was some interior Green candidate with some bad statements in the past or something, or some affiliation that was, you know, very not good. And it became an issue for a couple of days in the 2017 campaign. And that was a riding where the Greens would have been lucky to, I think, scrape more than 10 to 15%. Like, there's never been a case where they've been shy in the past. I don't really see the case why this campaign would be different on that.
Maybe Adrian Dix has had a hand in there and managed to get that. We're going to be positive on part of it anyway. But I want to move on to one last point on the recapping the campaign. Is just, I think the one thing that was frustrating, and I know it was frustrating for journalists that I've seen talk about on Twitter, is just what a difficult campaign this was to cover, not just because of the COVID restrictions where they couldn't necessarily be in person, but the campaigns themselves seem to have made it extra difficult to be accessible, to be accountable, to be transparent. This predated the election campaign with the government limiting questions to press conferences and things like that. But when you're only able to call in when campaigns are canceling press conferences and not answering email, it gets a lot, and you can't just run into them on the campaign trail, it gets a lot harder for voters and the public and journalists to pull out the answers from people who want your votes.
Yeah, the journalists have been doing a great job in this rather tough situation, but I think the unfortunate reality is that overall, the way campaigning works in a pandemic has just led to less coverage, less of those kind of detailed back and forth that elicit a lot of interesting stuff and information and stories that come out of them. And I think that has played a big part in what's a campaign that's overall been, seems to have been more background noise in a lot of parts of the province than the main event of the fall for a lot of British Columbians.
And that's on top of so many news outlets facing years-long declining revenue, and then the extra exacerbation of the lost revenue and job security during the pandemic that hit so many sectors. So not a great situation from that point of view. The other thing I think I've seen that we've seen at every level of government is every time a government rolls back access from the press, the next government, no matter how cheery, sunny ways they promise to be, don't really go back to the access that was before. We saw this when Trudeau seemingly kept up a lot of the press practices that Harper was criticized for. So hopefully the press finds new ways to drag our politicians to account and answer some questions about what's going on, because we know that question period is very rarely fruitful for political discourse either. But one thing that has been a fun, useful transparency measure this year has been the Facebook ad library and our ability to go in and see what each of the campaigns is spending, at least on that section of the campaign. We can't tell what they're spending on TV ads or Google ads, but at least on Facebook, where a lot of people are, we can see what they're spending. All three parties spent more this week than they did last week. The NDP spent an additional $40,000, bringing their total up to $126,000. The Liberals spent about $500 more. Actually, they spent almost the same as last week, about $225,000 split between their Facebook page and Andrew Wilkinson's page. And the Greens finally started spending some money on Facebook, and they spent $35,000, which is an increase of $31,000 over last week. The Greens were bragging about record fundraising numbers following the debate, so it looks like they chose to spend some of that on Facebook ads. I didn't dig into what each of the parties was spending on their ads this time. Throw the link to the Facebook ad library in the show notes if you want to dig into that. But it is curious to always watch. I think CBC also had a good analysis piece on the fundraising that each party had going into this election, and how this was one of the first times, like we've talked about before, the NDP really had more money to spend because of the new rules than the Liberals.
Yeah, the NDP started this in the best position, and campaign fundraising hasn't been bad to them either. It hasn't stopped them, though, from repeating the same talking points of the Liberals being the big money party stuff, even though they aren't anymore. But, you know, why retire a talking point when it's no longer true?
They're the party that gets more donations from larger donors, even though those donors can only give $1,500 or whatever, as opposed to the Greens, by comparison, who get most of their donations from smaller donors. You just don't have three people cutting $200,000 checks anymore, which is, I think, better for our politics. All right, we've alluded to the one poll from Angus Reid this week. I guess all of them are coming out tomorrow. I know at least Research Co. will have one. I would expect Insights West and others to have them as well. The big news of the poll, though, was that it's arguably a tightening dynamic, as now there's only a 10-point gap between the NDP and the Liberals.
So with this could be an outlier, and we'll have to see tomorrow once the other polls are hopefully out. But hey, it's not uncommon for races to tighten a bit in the end as partisans come home a bit after being a little disenchanted with very lackluster campaigns often. And yeah, I think that's definitely been the case with a lot of the Liberals here. So they're sitting at 35% to the NDP's 45%. Greens are at 16%, with 4% going to other. So yeah, the NDP are going to run away with this one if there's any indication. And I don't think it's likely we'll see too much of a change between now and election day.
There was a little bit of interesting info in this poll on other questions. Notably, the Angus Reid asked about if people had voted in advance versus plan to vote on election day, and how that affected how they were going to vote. And they found a strong preference among advance and mail-in voters for the NDP versus in-person election day voters. It was a lot closer. Given the case numbers we've seen going up, it could be that discourages more people from going, which will suppress the vote a bit more on Saturday. Possibly to the NDP's advantage, if the rest of these numbers are to be believed. Of course, we won't know for 2 to 4 weeks, depending how long it takes them to count.
Yeah, so that's the other big thing is I believe there's a statutory 2-week requirement before the Elections BC can actually start counting the mail-in ballots, and that's so they can cross-reference against all of the in-person voting to confirm that no mail-in ballot is a duplicate of a ballot that someone cast in person. So yeah, we'll have that waiting time, and then after that, it's going to take a while to count the over 1 million mail-in ballots that have come in. So yeah,
for reference, there were 2 million ballots cast in 2017, roughly.
Yeah, so there's a lot of uncertainty. We're not likely to know very much on election night itself. Maybe the NDP will be so far ahead that there's very little chance that the Liberals will be able to close the gap. But regardless, it's going to be the case that we won't know who won individual ridings for quite a while.
Let's get into some of those individual ridings that we might be watching on Saturday night and then following well into November. I pulled a list from CBC that says 10 ridings to watch on in BC on election night, and I added a bunch of my own, getting 15, 17 ridings that are probably pretty interesting. We don't have to go through them all, but let's start on the island. Are there any races there you're particularly interested in?
Obviously, the three seats that the Green Party won last time and the two that they currently hold, who will actually be able to hold on to those, whether the Greens are going to be knocked back to one or even no seats in the legislature, is going to be quite impactful going forward. And that's about it for Vancouver Island. Not a particularly competitive region, except for the couple seats that the Greens and NDP fight back and forth on.
Courtney Comox was a couple hundred votes between Ronna Ray Leonard for the NDP and the Liberals in 2017. So that's definitely one to watch. Although if the NDP is surging and the Greens are at where they were or back a little, then I think Courtney Comox is a safe NDP seat. Oak Bay Gordonhead is definitely going to be the most interesting, given its past as a seat that's been held by basically every party in the legislature at one point or another. Victoria Beacon Hill could be interesting. It's Carol James's former riding after she's now retired. Kaylin Harris, who we interviewed in the 2017 election, was the NDP candidate then.
Green Party candidate.
Kaylin Harris in 2017 was the Green Party candidate there, and he actually performed a reasonably strong second place. He wasn't in the running to win because Carol James is quite popular. But there is a strong eco-socialist green contingent, like controversial Victoria councillor Ben Isaac, I think, endorsed the green candidate in Victoria Beacon Hill. So he does get the most vote, or he did get the most votes in the last municipal election. So I don't know, maybe that will carry some weight. Still feels like a pretty safe NDP seat. If the Greens are making gains, that's the kind of seat they'd be looking at.
Yeah, if the Greens are going to pick up seats anywhere, with the exception of like maybe one or two in the interior, which even then, where they finished second last time, would very much be Lanzos. Yeah, it's going to be the South Island where they, I think, stand to make the biggest gains. And so while we're talking here, just one quick correction. I did pull up the Elections BC returns. And it's 1 million votes combined have been cast between the advance voting and the mail-in. It's closer to 350,000 mail-ins that have been returned. I was combining those numbers in my head.
Coming across the ferry and into Vancouver, I think there's only a handful of seats that aren't held by the NDP in the actual city of Vancouver. I think the one the NDP is looking the most hard at is Sam Sullivan's constituency of Vancouver False Creek, but Michael Lee's Vancouver Langara could also be on the chopping block if the NDP are really strongly up in Metro Van and the city as much as they're suggesting.
So Vancouver False Creek was won by, I think, about 410, 420, somewhere in that range, votes last time. Very close riding, barely hung on by the Liberals. And since then, I think the rural-urban divide in BC has become more pronounced. The Liberals' popularity within kind of urban Vancouver has fallen a bit more. And then combined with the province-wide trends, I think it's going to be, I think, a very tough seat for them to hold. And I think it's very likely, if I was to put a percentage on, probably like 80 to 90% likelihood the NDP are going to pick it up this time.
Yeah, I've seen Sam Sullivan's tried to lean into a bit more of the populist, safer Vancouver, anti-overdose prevention site angle, which I find really disappointing for him, given his past as the mayor who helped bring in and legalize the first safe injection site in Canada. There's an article that Jen St. Dennis wrote for the Tie trying to explore where this shift is in his mind, or if it is a shift. Yeah, he's gone really hard on the get tough on this. I think it's disappointing is what I'll say. And Langara, I think, has some... Is Langara where Tessica Truong is running?
Yes, that's the riding she's running in.
Yeah, so she's pretty prominent candidate the NDP has there. So those will be two good ones to watch. The rest of Zone 2 of TransLink, I don't think holds too much that's that exciting. Burnaby is going to stay pretty orange and New West. Once you get out to Coquitlam-Burke Mountain and the two Maple Ridge seats, those were all really close in the last election. And those will be the bellwethers, I think, for this election. If the NDP takes those three, they're on their way easily to a majority.
Yeah, the Maple Ridge is, I think, the other notable riding where particularly overdose and addiction issues of being quite prominent in there. So it will be interesting to see how well the Liberals campaign on those issues play there versus in Vancouver Falls Creek. I think
there were a couple other... Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I think structurally they're going to have less... Or it's going to be less of an uphill battle on those ones than it will be in Vancouver Falls Creek.
There were a few other close results in the last election that are probably worth following, like Richmond, Queensborough, Surrey, Cloverdale. One that'll be really interesting is West Vancouver, Sea to Sky, where the Greens and NDP were very close with each other in second and third place, respectively. Both of them, 2,500, 3,000 votes behind Liberal Jordan Sturdy. But if the vote can really coalesce one way or the other in that riding, they can easily knock him off, I think. And so that one could be really interesting in a surprise. Going out into the valley, the more interesting seat, I think, to watch will be Chilliwack-Kent, where, as we discussed, Laurie Thronis is on paper the Liberal candidate, but not officially or not going to be the Liberal MLA if he does win. He's been kicked out of the party. And there's the strong independent running out there. So... that I know the Greens have also endorsed, or at least the local Green candidate has put his campaign behind. That could be the one independent who gets into the legislature. Unless only one Green gets in, and then the NDP have refused to recognize one person as a party. Which
is entirely reasonable.
And then we would have two independents.
Yeah, I know some Greens are a little salty about it. But there's absolutely no reason to grant official party status that just... any one person in the legislature by themselves.
The NDP have historical reasons for viewing two as the floor of party status. The interior feels like it should generally be a fairly safe Liberal sweep, although the NDP has a couple seats around there, but I think there are still some the NDP could look to pick up. Boundary Similkameen is among them. Fraser Nicola, where they've held in the past, that was Harry Lally's former riding. As you get up north, Skeena could be in play. And Nelson Creston is actually a really interesting one where the Greens place second as well, despite only spending $7,000 on their campaign in 2017. It's a very peak Nelson that the NDP and Greens were first and second in that riding.
Yeah, it's the one riding that the Greens have any shot at picking up in the interior. So it'll be interesting to watch that, but... with where the general trend is province-wide, I'd be surprised if that riding changes hands.
So we both put our predictions in the show notes. They were actually pretty similar.
Yeah, so I'm going to be honest. I took my numbers from Too Close to Call, one of the election aggregators, on this one because it's the smart money going with the aggregators and the models. And... honestly, it seems pretty on point, and there is just... I have trouble seeing a scenario where the NDP aren't clocking in roughly around there. So I have 56 NDP, 30 Liberals, and one Green.
I looked at the aggregators. I looked at Too Close to Call. I looked at 338. I looked at Eric Grenier's poll tracker. And a lot of them, I felt, leaned a little heavily on the Angus Reid poll, which I get because it's all we've had in a week, but I just don't know if I believe that poll or not. And so I'm just like going a little more bullish on the NDP, 58 to 29 Liberals, and the Greens just get wiped. And I lean that part on, unfortunately, their difficulty, the difficult situation they were put in where they weren't as prepared and they did not have as much money in the bank and they did not have the candidates in place. So to run that campaign is tough. And the NDP is, like you said, gunning for those seats because they can reasonably pick them up. And why wouldn't they? This is partisan politics. I like Sonia Firstenau and Adam Olsen as politicians. I think they've done a good job and I don't want them to lose, but where I'm putting my chips down is on a green wipeout, unfortunately.
Yeah, I do hope the Greens have at least one or two seats after this is all said and done. There are a lot of flaws with the Green Party, but like the provincial Green Party in BC is probably one of the least flawed incarnations of the Greens. Definitely way better than either the federal or the Vancouver Green Party is, and I'd kind of like to see that model prove successful rather than your Elizabeth May, Adrian Carr type Green parties. So here's hoping they at least still remain in the legislature after Saturday.
Hey, the Burnaby Greens are just Joey Shithead Keithley, and that seems pretty rad, so don't knock them all. I also don't know how well the Greens are doing out east. Let's wrap it up on our discussion on the election, then. We don't actually have detailed plans for election night, given the result polls close at 8, and we don't know how many polls will be how many results will be coming in that night, how many calls will be made. I think what we're going to do is like we did on the debate, we'll open up our Slack, we'll do like we did on the debate, we'll put a special channel in the Slack, we'll tell people who want to join and live chat with us and everyone else who's in there that they can do that. If things get really exciting, maybe we'll jump on for a quick live stream analysis or something like that.
Even if we have a sudden Liberal surge and they capture 60 seats?
Or if the Liberals concede it right away. Or hell, if the 801 Club version 2 comes out and knifes Wilkinson metaphorically that evening. But I also probably want to get to bed in a reasonable hour. I still have a toddler. So that's where we'll be. If you want to get access to the Slack, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/politicoast.
Let's jump into our second segment. We probably don't have to do this again. Federally, that is. So, well, BC was a bit sleeping this last week of the campaign. Ottawa had election fever ramped up to 11 as there was questions about whether the government would fall in a confidence vote of its own making, as on Wednesday, the House of Commons voted on a conservative proposal to create a special ethics committee or anti-corruption ethics committee, and the Liberals, in a bid to avert this outcome, slapped a confidence vote onto that to make it so if the committee was actually set up, it was a confidence vote against the government and we would all be in another election.
Creation a little bit last week in Quick Takes when we discussed how the NDP had sided with the Liberals to not release some documents in one committee, but the NDP and Conservatives were talking in different ways about creating an anti-corruption committee of some form. Well, Trudeau, it turns out, has the power as Prime Minister, as any government does, to just deem that any vote is a confidence matter. And that is because, thanks to someone in our Slack who cited Peter Hogg, constitutional scholar, there isn't really a formal, this is a confidence motion thing in the House of Commons rules. It's literally just the Prime Minister saying it is, and if the vote doesn't go his way, he just goes to Rideau Hall or the Governor General's house and asks for an election.
Yeah, there are some things that our confidence votes automatically, or at least by convention, that the government really can't declare this is not a confidence vote, and that would be the vote on the throne speech and the budget. But outside
that Liberals had just survived the throne speech vote, it felt unnecessary to test the confidence of the House again.
Oh, it wasn't necessary. This is a case of hardball, and we were talking earlier about how parties that come in learn the bad habits of their predecessors. And you know, the Liberals have clearly learned from the Harper Conservatives of how to run a minority government and play the various opposition parties off each other. And as Harper found out, and Trudeau is following in his footsteps on, with a decent strategy, you can basically always find one of the opposition parties that isn't willing to go to the polls at any one time and use their fear of an election to get the vote through. In this case, that was the NDP.
I feel like Harper was never as ham-fisted. He didn't randomly make things confidence motions that I recall.
Yeah, this was definitely more aggressive in that respect. But
and I'll play liberal devil advocate for a second. Like, I do understand the idea or the argument that if the House creates a committee to investigate how corrupt you are as a government, it does sound like they don't have confidence in your ability to not be corrupt.
On the other hand, it's hard to know if you should lack confidence in the government if you can't do the investigation to find out the underlying situation.
Oh yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I was just trying to see what the not clearly don't investigate us because we totally have nothing to hide argument was.
Yeah, I will give you this. That was a much more coherent argument than one of their MPs put out, who compared Parliament holding the government accountable to the House Committee on Un-American Activities, the McCarthy's famous or infamous committee, which was absolutely absurd and not a comparison that should be trotted out lightly.
Yeah, the conservative breadth and how they talked about it had a whiff of that in terms of we're going to root out all the corruption and tone it down, boys. But
yeah, so yeah, I think the
given
down
that
boys
we have gotten to the bottom of the Wii scandal, I think it is worth pursuing it, especially since the NDP cut off one of the approaches we could have had to that.
Yeah, and like the government is acting super suspicious with how much it is doing to try and keep the various commons committees from either being formed or actually investigating the Wii thing. So there's clearly something underneath this that's worth digging into a little bit more. But as has been the continuing problem for the conservatives since at least the election of Andrew Scheer and maybe longer than that, they have not learned how to modulate their attacks at all, and they need to take about 10 to 20% off, and they'd actually be more successful in a lot of these cases because they overplay their hand. They come at this too aggressive, and then they give the opportunity for the NDP to get cold feet about it or find enough reason for them to not want to go along with this. And if they'd, rather than we talked about pulling in the husband of the chief of staff and investigating him for something the ethics committee or sorry the ethics commissioner already declined to investigate, like they would not have had nearly or it would not have been nearly as like clearly a political play, like a blatant political play. And if it'd be much more of a case where they're just putting together a committee, one that's chaired by the opposition, gives them more investigative powers but isn't so clearly aimed at going on a fishing expedition for every bit of dirty laundry the Liberals had, I think it would have actually been more successful. And the Conservatives want to have success. They need to learn how to be just slightly less aggressive and a little more subtle in all of this, and they'd actually have a lot more success.
The second kick at this can almost came as the Conservatives announced what their opposition motion will be next week, and the Liberals' initial response was maybe we'll make that a confidence vote as well. In this motion that's coming, I believe, on Monday next week, the Conservatives are going to push they're going to push the health committee to do a full review of Canada's COVID-19 response, looking at things like, why aren't we doing more rapid testing in Canada? And things that are reasonable questions to ask. But the Liberals are claiming that this will paralyze the civil service and we won't be able to do anything to respond to this.
Such a bullshit argument.
We should.
The government of the day is accountable to the House of Commons. It cannot be the case that the House will render the government unfunctional by exercising its most basic oversight and accountability.
But thankfully, the Liberals decided that would not be a confidence vote, because we have now tested the confidence a couple times, and the NDP, and I should also mention the Greens and Independent, Jody Wilson-Raybould, supported the Liberals in that vote this week. There was a question of whether the Greens would matter, because for a while it seemed like the NDP might just abstain, in which case the Greens and Jody Wilson-Raybould could have been the deciding votes over whether we went to an election.
But that wasn't ultimately how it went. I do like the idea of doing a thorough investigation of Canada's COVID response, because a major problem I think Canada's had is that, like a lot of situations, we are very focused on what the Americans do and how we compare to that, and are pretty much blind to anything else happening in the world. Like, people love to give Americans shit for only thinking about America, but Canadians are almost as bad when it comes to being too North American focused. And the COVID response has been one of those situations where that's been quite apparent, because while we have done a lot better than the disaster that has been America's response to the pandemic, there are many countries in many parts of the world that have handled this better than we have, whether it's South Korea or Taiwan or several European countries. And the fact that Canadians are happy to pat themselves on the back for not being as big a disaster as Trump's America has been, it's not something we should, as Canadians, be happy with. And we should definitely aim a little higher. And hopefully a thorough review of this will actually reveal the shortcomings, accountability can be had, and we'll actually be able to focus on what a successful pandemic response would be, not just a grading on a curve decent pandemic response would be.
Fair enough. I do think there is a question of whether that review is best done now or later. I can see arguments for both. It's probably worth doing sooner than later so that we can improve as we go along. Overall, it's good we're not going to an election federally. I saw a lot of people trying to criticize Jagmeet Singh for saying, oh, we shouldn't go to we shouldn't put Canadians at risk by going to a federal election. He campaigned in the BC election, and John Horgan threw him under the bus saying, I didn't ask him to come campaign here. But the material situations are different at the two levels. Like, when BC started its election campaign, we were at the cusp of what would become our second wave. We can see we're in a bad situation in Alberta, starting to get there in BC. Ontario and Quebec are basically looking at lockdowns again. It would be really bad to start an election campaign now.
Yeah, well, in BC's case, I do think that is a fairly fair point on the kind of hypocrisy of it, because today we did set a new record that was that broke yesterday's previous record for COVID cases. And it's, I think I said this at the beginning of the campaign, or one or two super spreader events from having case numbers where Ontario or Quebec is. The facts of exponential growth are such that no matter where you start, one or two bad things can leave you in a very bad position. And you could argue that BC's done fairly well, even if the second wave has hit us worse. But just as a normative statement, I think it's good for leaders to focus on dealing with crises rather than maneuvering for political gain by calling elections that don't need to be called. regardless of whether the underlying crisis gets worse or not in the intervening time.
Well, closing off on quick takes, sticking with the federal liberals and possible scandals, it turns out there was a, quote, potential for a scandal, according to liberal official François Landry, who was an aide who was working with Justice Minister David Lametti last year, on how the federal government has been appointing judges. CBC has a detailed article talking about how the PMO was getting involved in judicial appointments, which is the Prime Minister's prerogative, but the Liberals campaigned and pushed for a much more nonpartisan process where there's a more merit-based appointment. What he's alleging in here is that there's a lot of connections to the Liberal caucus, resources being used to vet judges, potential judges, as well as sometimes it bouncing to the party side, which gets really inappropriate, as well as keeping track of who lawyers are donate, which political parties lawyers are donating to. Not saying that affects whether or not they get appointments, but it all looks really bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's not affecting appointment decisions, why are they even looking at it? But more fundamentally, one of Canada's great strengths is that it has a nonpartisan judiciary. And in the aftermath of the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, you know, I heard a lot of Canadians trumpet the fact that they couldn't name a single Supreme Court justice in Canada. And that was a good thing because it showed how unpartisan they are and how, you know, relatively inconsequential any one appointment is, because there isn't an underlying political dynamic at work there. And I don't think it's that level of civic ignorance is particularly good, although admittedly I think I could maybe name three if I thought about it. There's definitely something to the reason why people were talking about it, and I do have concerns that we may be at the start of a trend line that goes in the wrong direction on this, both with what this story has in it, as well as the legitimacy laundering that has been done in recent years by the use of ex-Supreme Court justices to basically legitimize things governments want to do. Yeah, it's concerning. Don't want to. Hopefully this isn't the start of a long-term trend. Anything else to say on that one?
Nope.
The other bit of news out of Ottawa is the House of Commons, particularly the Subcommittee on International Human Rights, has made a rather definitive call that the mistreatment of the Uyghurs in China constitutes a genocide. And I believe it's the first parliamentary pronouncement anywhere in the world of this, and I think it's going to have rather significant implications for how Canada handles things going forward with China.
The committee has a report out that we'll link to in the show notes, and it's endorsed by all parties or all members of the committee, as far as I could tell. So there's no like such and such a party released a supplementary or competing minority report that would use different language. No, they all call on the government to do five things: condemn the actions against the Uyghurs and Turkic Muslims, work with allies around the world to help get international observers to get unfettered access in there, provide overseas development assistance to organizations working in there, recognize acts being committed against the Uyghurs as genocide, and impose sanctions through Canada's Magnitsky Act version, essentially limit the funds and access to funds of Chinese government officials to try to put pressure on them to not be evil. China's pissed, unsurprisingly, because they deny that this is a genocide, and so they call for us to stop lying about them. The committee heard from multiple witnesses, and as far as I can tell, did its due diligence here. Most human rights organizations agree the situation is really bad.
Yeah, I think at this point it's pretty unambiguous what's going on in Shenzhen. I think I'm pronouncing that. Actually, I know I'm not pronouncing that right. I think I got relatively close. The region in the northwest of China where this is happening. But yeah, China's maintaining a hard stance up towards any country speaking out about this. So I'm happy to see that we've not been cowed on this one. Foreign Affairs Minister François-Philippe Champagne had a less, I think, definitive statement, more along the lines of needing to continue investigations on this, while saying that Canada takes allegations of genocide very seriously. So that was slightly disappointing to see the Foreign Affairs Minister take a less definitive tack than I would like to see it. But I think it's a good sign the committee's endorsed this, but it wouldn't surprise me if, in addition to the stern words that came from the Chinese ambassador, if we see more responses in the coming days.
The ultimate difficulty here is Canada is such a weak, middling power that while we can say the right things, China's not going to care, and China can do a lot more geopolitical harm to us than we can to them. That's not a reason not to do the right thing. It's just the difficulty of being our place in the world.
This isn't going to be a repeat of 1945 where Allied troops go in and liberate camps. The response is going to have to be a lot different. And the only way that is actually going to work is if an alliance of like-minded countries actually come together on this one and act in unison, because that's the only way you can counter a country of China's size. So hopefully the next steps are starting to strengthen ties with both the countries around China's periphery that have strained relations with China, as well as the Europeans, who I think are the other significant counterweight besides the U.S., who will hopefully in January come around on a lot of this stuff and be a more reliable partner. But in the meantime, to start to act on this finding, it's going to require a lot of diplomatic work with our allies and building new alliances.
To close off, as we mentioned earlier, we're seeing an increasing rise in number of cases. Dr. Bonnie Henry's language this week has been much stronger than recently. She emphasized people should be sticking to your household and maybe your safe six friends, but really, if you don't have to go to a social event, don't. Let's all stay the fuck home. I think if you can work from home, it's time to start doing that again. Let's get these case numbers down, especially here in Fraser Health, where it seems like they all are with me. I don't like that. Stay home, people. Wash your hands, wear a mask, all the things you're supposed to do, and vote.
And once again, we'll throw all the links to the Elections BC where to vote information and how to vote information in the show notes. So if you aren't sure how to vote or haven't voted yet, do check that out and make sure you vote this Saturday. And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.